The experience of worshiping in a different space can give a bit of a different perspective. So I'd like to offer tonight two observations from our time in the Undercroft, which was a brief chapter, just over a week. And to preface the first observation by saying that it surprised me how nice the space looked when it was finished. I don't know what I really expected as we were preparing the Undercroft, but there are many churches that don't come together in a space that was as nice as what we worshiped in last weekend. So it impressed me the way that it looked, but there were some needs for improvisation to allow every space to meet the need that we have when we worship. Here in the church, we have these two spaces that help us prepare for Mass. One is the vesting room in that corner, and then in the other corner, a sacristy that helps us prepare for Mass. And we don't have those, obviously, in the Undercroft. So the improvisation was to combine both in this very small space that's referred to as the bride's room. In my time here, I've covered just about every nook and cranny of our campus. But believe it or not, I'd never been to the bride's room before, and probably I'll never go there again. I don't have any plans to. It served the purpose, but another space that we needed was a confessional. We didn't have confessions last Saturday because of the Derby. We didn't have Mass on Saturday, but on Wednesdays, we have quite a few people that work downtown that come for confessions. And in the Undercroft, there's not a confessional. I thought that maybe there wouldn't be a huge crowd, but both Wednesdays, there were a lot of people. And what I did on short notice was I put two chairs in the space between the Undercroft and the St. Louis room on this side. There's a bit of a hallway, a stairwell that leads out into this courtyard. And while I was hearing confessions, one of the prominent Easter images or symbols was coming to mind, and it's the image of a tomb. If you've been in that space before, it's a little bit dark and cool, and it recalls in a way something of a tomb. Easter begins with this image of the tomb. On the first Sunday of Easter in John's Gospel, Mary Magdalene, very early in the morning, while it's still dark, goes to the tomb, and she sees that the stone has been rolled away. And then Peter and the beloved disciple go inside the tomb and leave, and all three people, they're changed. They're never quite the same after that moment. And they leave proclaiming a message that is still being proclaimed in our world in this day. Something that's kind of fascinating to think about. How many messages that were proclaimed 2,000 years ago are still being shared with the world? And this is one. They're changed people because of what they experience. And the tomb itself is a prominent image in Christianity, carries into the early church as well, especially in Rome. The early Christians in Rome worshipped in the catacombs, these subterranean passageways during a time of persecution, where a number of the early Christians were later buried. The image of the tomb as well carries in a way into our own day, because Christ leaving the tomb changes who we are, what it means to be alive, what it means to be a Christian. And I think in the Easter season, there's an invitation to us from Christ that not only he should leave the tomb, but we should leave the tomb as well in our earthly lives, a place of isolation, of emptiness, to leave, to enter into the light of faith, and to be changed men and women, children, sharing a new message with the world. The Lenten season has something of a process to it, a program. We think of what we will do, what we will not do, but we usually don't have a program for Easter. We don't think in those terms, but maybe we should in terms of this reality of leaving the tomb, the isolation, the emptiness that we can so easily find in our world and in our lives, to move out of that inwardness into a light of faith. Second, image that came to mind was to recall an important event that happens in the Undercroft. We have very often receptions, we have presentations there, but there's another event that we have regularly. It's very important in the life of the church that a lot of people might not know about, and it's a bereavement meal. When we have a funeral mass here in the church, and we go to the graveside for a committal service, oftentimes, family and friends will return to the Undercroft for a meal to share together. And at that point, they've prayed together, they've shed tears together, But it's fascinating to observe these bereavement meals because there's an astonishing phenomenon that takes place every time. There's a tide that you can watch beginning to turn. Although the circumstance is very sad, there's always a point if you watch that people begin to share stories about the person who has died. They begin to tell jokes, they begin to smile, they begin to laugh. Even there's a sense of levity that can settle in people. Acquaintances are renewed, people that haven't seen one another in a while catch up, they meet one another. Usually a few kids are running around playing games of some sort. And a takeaway for me in these moments is that in the Christian life, we can't stay down for long. There's something that's always lifting us up, even on days of sadness and hardship. To be a Christian ultimately is to be on an upward journey. It's okay to be sad, disappointed, frustrated, angry, but these are passing phenomena. There's something, if we listen closely, if we feel closely to the journey that we're on, that's always lifting us up, always bringing us higher and higher, closer to God. Both of these observations, in a way, are pointing in the direction of the Good Shepherd. Who is it that leads us out of the tomb, out of isolation, out of indifference, exile, out of a sense of abandonment? It's the Good Shepherd that is leading us into the light of faith. There are multiple places in the Gospels where the Gospel writers record, "His heart was moved with pity for the crowds, for they were like sheep without a shepherd." Somehow Christ is seeing in us a temptation to isolation, indifference, a temptation towards emptiness, and leading us, like a flock, out of the tomb into a sense of new life. And if we think of the latter image of a meal in the moment of sadness, who is it that leads us out of a sense of loneliness and sadness into a meal? Who is it that's feeding us, not just with bread and wine, but feeding us with his own lifeblood, feeding us with himself? It's the Good Shepherd who is leading us and feeding us with himself. We have this very small gospel from John chapter 10, a passage that speaks of Christ as the Good Shepherd. There's a great image at the heart of it in which Christ says of the sheep, "No one can take them out of my hand." It's a very compelling visual. And it reminds me of an image that I've shared with you before of a little-known Irish saint who lived in the 6th century, Saint De Colas. He lived a long life, and as a young man, he went to become a monk in a monastery. The monastery had a famous abbot, Saint Columba, who founded many monasteries in Ireland. And later, De Colas, he grows up, he moves to another place, and he founds a new monastery, lives a long life. There's not many details about him, though, because he lived so long ago. But there is a great exchange between him as a young man and this abbot, Saint Columba. So Columba says to the young man, "De Colas, why are you always smiling?" De Colas, as a young man, says, "Because no one can take God from me." I always think it's a fascinating line. Why are you smiling? Why would anyone ever smile? "Because no one can take God from me." Somehow, the hand of the Good Shepherd keeps us tight in his grasp. Even if we don't feel it, acknowledge it, even if we're forgetful sometimes of his presence in our lives. And these simple words from this young person speak to an encounter with the Good Shepherd in a powerful way. And if it's possible in his life to have had such an encounter, it's certainly possible for us as well.